supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. A federal appeals court today affirmed New Jersey's bail overhaul law that took effect last year. It's a win for advocates for the changes to the Garden State's criminal justice system, and it's a major blow to the bail bonds industry, which is losing business as a result. WHYY's Joe Hernandez joins me to examine today's decision. And Joe, first off, take us back to January 2017. What happened then?
Well, Dave, that's when the bail overhaul effort began in January of 2017. And basically what that meant is cash bail is virtually eliminated. Not totally, but almost eliminated. And this happened for two reasons. It was so poor defendants who were getting stuck in jail for months ahead of trial because they couldn't pay bail. Now they were going to be able to get out of jail and await trial and continue to work, live at home. And it also, for the first time, allowed judges in the state to hold people in jail who they thought were extreme risks of committing another crime if they were released, or risks of not showing up to court. And this wasn't allowed before. Judges had to set monetary bail for pretty much everybody.
And so, as you're alluding, the new bail system scores defendants. I suppose those are some of the criteria.
Some of the criteria include the crime alleged, the person's age, whether they've been to court before or been in jail before, things like that.
Fast forwarding to today, when three federal judges in Philadelphia ruled against a man who'd brought a challenge to the state's bail overhaul. What was the finding?
Right. So this guy had sued the state of New Jersey. He'd been arrested for aggravated assault, and he didn't have to pay bail. He was let out of jail, but he was let out with conditions. He was on house arrest, and he had to wear a GPS monitor. And he basically sued the state and said, look, I have a constitutional right to pay bail if I can do it, that I should be able to pay and get out of jail if I have that ability. And the court basically said, no, there is no constitutional right to pay cash bail and get out of jail. There's a constitutional right not to have excessive bail, but not everybody should just have that option. That's not in the Constitution. And this ruling was hailed by proponents of New Jersey's bail overhaul, people like Alex Shalom with the ACLU.
Cash bail hurts poor people. Cash bail has deleterious effects on fairness, on public safety, and on justice. And the court recognized that. The court said explicitly that monetary bail often deprived presumptively innocent defendants of their pretrial liberty.
Are there other challenges pending to the new law?
Yeah, there are other challenges. One is from a woman who lives in southern New Jersey, and her son was murdered, allegedly by a guy who had been in jail on a gun charge and then released per this bail overhaul. So she's basically suing the state and saying, whatever you're doing, it's not working if you let a guy out of jail who then later went on to allegedly murder my son.
Has there been enough evidence yet to determine the success of the program?
That depends a lot on who you ask and how you define success. So the state court system is working on and soon should be releasing data on whether people who are released pending trial commit other crimes or whether they skip court at a later date. And, you know, the bail bonds industry, which has been really, really opposed to this whole bail overhaul, has been saying when those stats come out, we're going to see that people are released on nothing but a promise, they say, and then they go on to do more crimes or not show up for court. However, the state is also showing much lower numbers in the amount of people in jail, in the jail population. And this is one thing that proponents will say is a huge success, that fewer poor people are waiting in jail pending trials simply because they can't afford to pay however much bail is to get out.
Are there other states that have a similar program in place for a longer period that we can look to as a likelihood of how this could play out?
No, New Jersey actually was really in the front of the pack as far as this goes. There are other cities and counties, other jurisdictions that are doing similar things, and other states that are using a computer algorithm that New Jersey is using to score whether people should be released or not. But New Jersey is really the first state to do this bail overhaul in a very comprehensive way, in the way that it did it.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks a lot, Dave.
WHYY's Joe Hernandez on NewsWorks Tonight. A Pennsylvania judge emerges as a top contender for President Donald Trump's pick for the next Supreme Court justice. Appeals Judge Thomas Hardiman sits on the Philadelphia-based 3rd U.S. Circuit of Court of Appeals, and he's on the short list of four jurists. As WHYY's Bobby Allen reports, legal scholars see Hardiman as a reliable conservative, but someone whose opinions sometimes surprise.
During a decade on the federal appeals bench, if Hardiman has become known for one thing, it's his view of Second Amendment gun rights protections. Clark Neely studies criminal justice issues at the Cato Institute.
He seems to be particularly protective of Second Amendment rights compared to other federal court of appeals judges that have weighed in on the issue.
His opinions indicate he sees the Second Amendment as almost limitless. He wanted to see a New Jersey law struck down because it made permit applicants justify why they needed a gun in public. And he has written that a felony conviction shouldn't prevent you from getting a gun. Adam Winkler, a professor at UCLA's law school, has called Hardiman a, quote, Second Amendment extremist.
In Thomas Hardiman's world, gun rights are even more expansive than they were at the founding.
Hardiman has approved of strip-searching jail inmates, and he has sided with police in disputes over whether citizens can film law enforcement activity. Matthew Stiegler, a Philly lawyer who runs a blog on the Third Circuit, says it's fair to call Hardiman a staunch conservative, but he says Hardiman's opinions do not always line up with traditional conservative perspectives. For instance, Hardiman has ruled in favor of gay men facing discrimination, an African-American firefighter, and a Honduran asylum seeker fleeing violence.
He has a little bit of an underdog perspective that's informed how he looks at cases as a judge.
His life story has a bit of an underdog element, too. He's a first-generation college student who drove a taxi to put himself through school. And as a graduate of Georgetown Law, he'd be the only high court justice without Ivy League credentials. Quinn Hillier, a conservative columnist with National Review, says Hardiman's upbringing may make him more appealing to Trump.
Hardiman's story is much more everyman than any of the others.
Hardiman, who lives in Pittsburgh, has the backing of Judge Marianne Trump Barry. That's President Trump's sister, who served alongside Hardiman as a Third Circuit judge. She reportedly called her brother to tell him that Hardiman should be his pick. Bobby Allen, WHYY News.
In the context of protests in Philadelphia calling for curtailing contact between local and federal authorities regarding immigrants, let's get legal perspective on the animus behind the acronyms PARS and ICE with Susan Lynn, partner at Caris, Rudofsky, Messing, Feinberg, and Lynn. Susan, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with PARS. What does that stand for? What does it mean?
So PARS, the official acronym is for the Preliminary Arraignment Reporting System. It is a database. A computer database that's operated by the City of Philadelphia, which includes the Philadelphia Police Department, the First Judicial District, and the District Attorney's Office.
Does it pertain specifically to cases involving immigrants?
No. So anytime somebody is arrested in Philadelphia, a Philadelphia police officer arrests somebody within the county of Philadelphia, the officer will collect information that ends up going into the PARS system. That information will include things like a description of why the person was arrested, the name of the person, the address of the person, and what I believe has immigrant advocates worried, it includes the place of birth of the person who was arrested.
Ah, so it's specifically that piece of information that is causing the controversy.
I believe that that is the most significant piece of information that is causing concern for those who are advocating for the protection of immigrants.
And what about that information being of such interest to ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement?
Well, I mean, frankly, it's often code for somebody, or it can be seen as code for somebody's immigration status. I think the worry among many immigrant advocates is that somebody who works for ICE can take a look at this information, can put together a person's place of birth, perhaps make assumptions about the person's name. There may be information in the system at some point that's put into the PARS system regarding somebody's language of choice. And with all that, an ICE agent may be able to make an assumption or make a guess about somebody's immigration status, see that they've been recently arrested, and see where they live.
But as a practical matter, is it fair to say that federal authorities can make already a pretty educated guess based on available data?
So ICE has access to other databases, including NCIC, or something that at least used to be called AFIS. I think it has a different name now. But these are national computer criminal databases that provide criminal history or contacts, information about the contact that people have had with the criminal justice system, which will include people's name. It will include any prior arrests that person may have had, what they've been charged with, what they've been convicted of. And ICE has that information. And arrests that Philadelphia police officers make will ultimately get updated or uploaded into this NCIC database. The difference between NCIC and PARS is that PARS is much more immediate. It's a real-time database. The information gets entered right away. It becomes available right away. Whereas for NCIC, there's often a lag time of, I've heard, anywhere from 2 weeks to a month.
Also in real time, the PARS contract, as currently written, expires the end of August. What are the determinants by which it will either be renewed, changed, or eliminated?
Well, so I don't know that I can speak to that. It is a determination that's going to have to be made by the Court of Common Pleas of Philadelphia, or the First Judicial District, rather, by the District Attorney's Office and by the City of Philadelphia.
Is it discretionary on their parts?
It is discretionary. There's no requirement, as far as I know, that they allow ICE to access the PARS system. I know that in the recent case that was in front of the Federal District Court here regarding the Sanctuary City policies, that PARS was something that was discussed. But I did recently review the opinion, and it doesn't seem to me that Philadelphia has to give ICE access to PARS in order to satisfy everything that was required by that opinion.
Susan Lynn, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Thank you for having me.
Susan Lynn, partner at Carey's, Rudofsky, Messing, Feinberg, and Lynn on NewsWorks Tonight. The Farm Bill is a massive $860 billion piece of legislation covering everything from crop insurance to land conservation to SNAP benefits, which provide food assistance. As the Senate finalizes its version of the bill, the House-passed plan could have a big impact on what the final measure looks like. It could cut off food benefits for 400,000 households and create stricter work requirements for more than 5 million low-income Americans. But it also cuts environmental programs that benefit from the Farm Bill. For WHYY, the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports.
Pennsylvania Congressman Glenn Thompson is vice chair of the House Agriculture Committee, and he's proud of the bill passed by the full House.
I was impressed, actually. That's the first time we would have, that I know of history, that we'd be able to pass a farm bill with just Republican votes.
Nearly 80% of the money in the farm bill goes to food assistance for people in need, and Thompson says he's pleased with changes to the SNAP food programs. The Farm Bill also provides billions for subsidies and crop insurance, and it doles out billions of dollars to help improve environmental practices on farms.
What I think everybody needs to understand is this Farm Bill, and specifically the conservation title, is about really about clean water, clean air, healthier soils, more habitat for wildlife.
But a review by the Congressional Budget Office finds that the House Farm Bill reduces total spending on conservation programs by nearly $800 million over 10 years. Colin O'Neill is legislative director with the Environmental Working Group. In a recent report, it found that runoff from farms is damaging drinking water in many states.
We know that the farm pollution problem, and especially how it impacts water, is only getting worse. And we simply can't be taking a step back and reducing funding for these valuable programs, which are already underfunded.
Fertilizers, pesticides, manure, and sediment from farms have been blamed for everything from feeding toxic algae blooms in Lake Erie to pollution in Chesapeake Bay to the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. O'Neill explains that a variety of programs funded through the Farm Bill help farmers adopt voluntary conservation practices to reduce runoff from their farms.
Like planting cover crops, putting in buffers around rivers and streams, and applying nitrogen more efficiently. All those in combination can really dramatically improve water quality and the quality of America's drinking water.
One program at issue in the 2018 Farm Bill, the Conservation Stewardship Program. It provided Pennsylvania farmers a loan with nearly $8 million last year, helping farmers who've already worked on environmentally beneficial projects and want to do more to improve soil, air, and water quality on their farms. Yet the Farm Bill passed by the House this month eliminates the Conservation Stewardship Program. Congressman Thompson says the program is being rolled into a larger one known as EQIP, the Environmental Quality Incentives Program.
We're gaining some efficiencies, there's no doubt about it.
That will still mean a net reduction in funding of nearly $5 billion over 10 years. Critics, like the Environmental Working Group, say the EQIP already turns away nearly two-thirds of farmers who apply for assistance. Hannah Smith Brubaker runs an organic vegetable, hen, and sheep farm in central Pennsylvania. She's also director of PASA, the Pennsylvania Association for Sustainable Agriculture. She says while the EQIP tends to focus on large monoculture farms, the newer Conservation Stewardship Program has worked better for the smaller diversified farms.
Diversified farms tend to think that the Farm Bill doesn't really offer them much support at all, and so when there finally is a program that is helpful and accessible and then it gets eliminated, it just sort of reinforces that belief that the Farm Bill is not really, you know, it's not for me.
Smith Brubaker and others are more supportive of the bipartisan Senate version of the Farm Bill, which maintains the Conservation Stewardship Program. The Pennsylvania Farm Bureau represents thousands of farmers, including large-scale agricultural producers. Spokesman Mark O'Neill says that the state received $60 million for conservation programs from the Farm Bill just last year. But he isn't worried about cuts in the House bill.
We think that as the negotiations between both sides go forward, there will be adequate funding for those programs.
O'Neill says the Farm Bureau is pleased to see the bill moving forward because his farmers want to see it finalized before September 30th when the current Farm Bill expires. I'm Julie Grant.
It's taken more than 3 years and 177 million miles to chase down a half-mile-long cube, but a Japanese spacecraft is ready to survey its target and hopefully complete the round trip with a souvenir in tow. Let's take aim with Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, tell us about Hayabusa 2.
Hayabusa 2 follows on with a previous mission of the Japanese Space Agency to go out and visit an asteroid. And this particular asteroid, about 3,000 feet wide, is the target for this one. There's going to be a string of encounters that include flybys and several landings actually down onto the surface of this asteroid in which three rovers and a lander will operate on the surface of this asteroid and try to bring us back a little sample of what it's like.
But this isn't a rover like the Mars rovers.
Oh, no. We're talking about something way, way, way smaller, but the instrumentation that's on board these rovers will help us better characterize what asteroids are like, what this particular asteroid is like, but it helps us to complete the picture of what our solar system really is comprised of.
In a general sense, what are asteroids in the inner belt like?
We always have to remember that what we see of our solar system's arrangement and organization now actually is the result of billions of years of intense dynamics and jockeying around, fighting for space, banging back and forth, tidal forces and gravitational pull really shaping the way the solar system has finally set itself up. And so when we look at these objects that we find in this particular location, located between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter, in some cases, we're looking at parts of crust. In some instances, we're looking at pieces of inner planetary material, like the mantle and the core of a planet that once existed in this location.
Has this part of the solar system finally set itself up, or is it continuing to evolve?
Back in 1989, I want to say it was, Comet Shoemaker-Levy 9 crashed into Jupiter and created a series of bruises, if you will, what looked like bruises in the upper atmosphere. 26 pieces of a comet fell into the atmosphere of Jupiter. And a good friend of mine, comet hunter David Levy, said, "This is a reminder that the solar system is still under construction." Although the number of the largest asteroids and meteoroids and things like that has dropped considerably over the course of the billions of years of our planet as they orbit the sun, sweeping up this material, but there's still some significant ones out there.
Do we know enough about this one's trajectory to know if it's going to come close anytime soon?
This isn't one that we have to worry about, thank goodness. In fact, we've been able to identify that there are no asteroids out there that are threatening to us in any way for at least the next century. Now, that's big planet killers. We do have to try to get a better handle on the number of city killers, if you will, the smaller ones that can do significant regional damage.
I don't know if we can see anything that dramatic in the night sky this week, but with clear skies, what's available overhead?
I would submit that indeed we do get to see some really incredible things right here in our own sky with our own eyes. Coming up at the end of this week, for example, on Sunday night, the moon and Venus will be together in the evening sky over in the west just before sunset. And if you look back toward the south, you'll find the largest planet, Jupiter. A little further to the left, to the east, you'll find Saturn. And if you stay up until 11 p.m., Mars will be rising up above the eastern horizon. This gives us four beautiful planets to be seen in the evening sky easily for the next month and a half or so. Highly recommended that you get out and get a good view, as this particular setup of planets won't be seen this way for quite a few years going forward.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, NewsWorks Tonight.